someone who understands both markets and power and looks at policies in India with a nationalistic approach. Shaurya Dhawal, welcome to India, Russia and the World.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
India's growth story, it looks very strong, from $4 trillion today to potentially $7 trillion by the end of the decade. Now, every story has a weak point. Tell me what worries you the most right now.
You know, Einstein said the eighth wonder of the world is the power of compounding. And in finance, power of compounding is the strongest power. So India's move from $4 trillion to 8 trillion-ish by the end of this decade, and maybe 25, 30 by the time India heads about 100 years of independence, is pretty much now is the power of momentum taking over. It's just the power of compounding that is going to take over. So economically, India faces few risks. Of course, there will be bumps in India's trajectory in terms of its economic and its GDP growth. Where India's GDP growth faces the biggest risk is from geopolitical or domestic events which are non-economic, which may derail India's economic growth trajectory.
Something like an Iran war.
Yes, very sure. Because you see, India today depends on about 85% of its energy on through imports. So India is essentially a very big economy, but a huge dependence on energy imports. Now, extended periods of either disruption to its energy supplies or increased cost of energy could lead to a situation where this could have inflationary pressures, it could slow down economic growth, lead to other cascading effects, and thereby derail India's growth trajectory from whatever 8-9% to maybe 5-6%, and therefore in the long run prohibit India from reaching the number that you just mentioned by 2030. Of course, India will get to that, but then India may not get to that in 2030. It may extend that by another 4-5 years.
Global investors, they suddenly love the India story. Why?
They love the India story because there are few economies in the world that have both the size of India and the speed of India's growth. So India offers an opportunity for investors to deploy huge amounts of capital because of its size. And then given India's nominal growth rate of somewhere between 7% and 10% is an outlier in the world, particularly for a large economy. So that's why investors love India. You can deploy a lot of money in India, and India has a lot of opportunity. It's a big market and it's a very fast growing economy.
Also, Shaurya Dhawal, India has built a powerful digital public infrastructure. But do you think that can translate into global dominance, or is this more of a domestic success story?
This digital public infrastructure is an open digital public infrastructure. You know, our Trinity Jam, this Jan Dhan, all these things, Aadhaar, etc. This is a great opportunity for India to take this open architecture and extend it to all other countries in the world, particularly the global south countries. And therefore, I don't look at it as a dominance tool. It's more of a collaborative tool. Yes, it will give India a lot of soft power, and will give India a lot of goodwill in these countries, because this actually has transformed the life of millions of Indians. And I think the world deserves it. There are 1 billion people in Africa, right, who could benefit from that. This leads to better governance. It leads to lesser wastage of funds. It leads to direct delivery of public goods and services to individuals and to families. So I think India and Indians have benefited from it. And therefore, India should extend it. And India does want to extend it across the world to whoever is willing to take it up.
We're seeing from Chabahar to other new trade routes, India is clearly thinking long-term in the region, in the West Asian region. Is this more about economics, or is this quiet power projection for India?
Economic power of India is part of India's net comprehensive national power. So I don't think you can distinguish the two and say this is just a pure economic play or a power play. This is both, but this is economic power play, right? And this is economic power play with the objective that India revitalizes the old trade routes, the old way by India had spread its influence for centuries across not just the region, but beyond the region as well. So I think that India is trying to lay down the infrastructure with like-minded countries in terms of building that kind of both hard and soft infrastructure that will allow India to trade across the world.
I also want to talk to you about the future of the Chabahar port, given the developments in the West Asian region.
Chabahar port is a strategically important port for India because it gives India access into the hinterland of West Asia. And India has taken a long-term view on it. And I guess, irrespective of where their political equations establish, India will continue to use the Chabahar port to get access to the landlocked countries. India enjoys a lot of goodwill in those Central Asian countries. And it's through this port that India will, in the absence of Pakistan giving us that access, right, to be able to provide India's economic benefits to these regions.
Let's say if the Strait of Hormuz, it remains blocked, not for days, but for months. What breaks first for India?
I think what breaks first for India is India's energy supplies. You will see an escalation in fuel prices and LPG prices, which will then lead to huge inflationary effects, which will then lead to tightening of monetary policy, which will lead to slowdown of economic growth. And I think then it could lead to other kinds of political upheavals in the country, because at the end of the day, India is a fast-growing economy. It's a young population, people. It's an upwardly mobile population. People want jobs. People want economic activity. And I think that extended delay in solving of this problem with Iran will have direct consequences on India's economic growth story.
But is India prepared for that, or is India just hoping that it doesn't happen?
No, no. See, every country is prepared for it, and every country is not 100% prepared for it. But the country, it's an evolving situation. And India has been taking appropriate steps to ensure that its oil supplies continue, whether they're from Gulf of Hormuz or from other parts of the world. And India has also been quite successful in being able to get its ships out from the Hormuz in terms of both the LPG as well as oil. And so I think India has been, and then India has its own strategic oil reserves. India has, you know, partnership agreements with many other countries. So I don't think India will be brought to the brink because of this extended blockade of Hormuz. But it's an unnecessary distraction to the Indian economy. And then, of course, India has also been very aggressively under Mr. Modi substituting its energy supplies by, you know, moving away from things like coal and fuel towards solar and wind, so that India can lead to a less dependence on import of energy from the rest of the world.
Do you not think that the situation in the West Asian region is pushing India back to, say, coal or chulas, things that Mr. Modi tried to pull India out of in the last decade or so?
Well, it's not pushing India back permanently. It is, you know, we've laid the infrastructure for gas, we've laid the infrastructure for electricity across the country. I think there could be a temporary disruption in supplies. If this thing, we haven't seen anything of yet, and God willing, we won't go there. But even the worst case, it may be just for some extended period, and then we should be fine on the other side.
Islamabad has opened some six land routes to Iran. How do you view this development?
I don't take it as seriously. What, Pakistan is a bankrupt country. What does Pakistan have to give to Iran? I mean, you know, it's like Iran isn't a problem. Iran needs to trade with countries that have actually got something to give to them, either medicines, food, fuel, manufacturing goods, or anything that enhances them to be able to continue their economic activity. Unfortunately, I don't understand what Pakistan can open six. Pakistan can open 60 trade routes. But what are they going to trade on there is the question.
You know, there are a lot of political churns that we're seeing in India's neighborhood, Nepal, Bangladesh. Do you think that India is losing influence in its neighborhood, or do you think India needs to rethink its neighborhood policy and re-engage with the new leadership that has come in, say, Bangladesh and Nepal?
I think India needs a peaceful, democratic, stable political environment around its, through its neighbors. And India basically works to ensure that without interfering in the domestic affairs of these countries and the people of these countries have the right to choose what kind of governance that they want. And I think any government that comes in this region may have, at times, may have different levels of collaboration or differences with India, and that's but natural. But I think none of them is beyond the influence and access to India. So India works with whoever comes in, either Bangladesh or Sri Lanka or Nepal, and all of them are India's friends. And I think the friendship extends beyond governments; it extends more from people to people. So I think that's where India's investments have been. So I don't look at any waning of India's influence in the region. As a matter of fact, I would say that with India's economic growth and with the economic trajectory that India has taken, India's influence is only increasing in the region.
In the next decade, by, say, 2036, will India become a manufacturing power or a digital superpower or something else?
That's a good question. Obviously, it does look unlikely India will be a big manufacturing power. I think that boat, we had some strategic mistakes, particularly the run-up between late 90s to 2014, when Mr. Modi brought back manufacturing into the center stage. India allowed its manufacturing to slip from 25% of its GDP to as low as 15% of its GDP. So that will take some time to come back.
A digital superpower then?
Yes, India definitely is coming to that. India definitely has the opportunity to be a digital superpower. India has laid a very solid foundation of its digital infrastructure. India is now aggressively moving on both AI and semiconductors. India is a big digital market. It has great mobile penetration. It's a big size market, and it's a good technological base. It's got good STEM education, good engineering colleges, etc. So a scientific bent of mind in the population. So I think India does definitely have the opportunity to be a digital superpower.
India buys Russian oil, it refines it, and then it sells it to Europe. What is India? A smart middleman?
No, India is a big refiner in the world. That's all, right? India has huge refining capacities. India takes global oil, and India refines it because it's one of the few big refining countries in the world with great facilities, and sells it all over the world. It's just like you say, India is a manufacturing power, India is a refining power. Russia happens to be one place. India gets oil from many other countries and refines it, sells it to different parts of the world. Now, certain geopolitical events have happened as a result of which this has become a little bit of an issue. That's a geopolitical issue. It's not an economic issue. So I don't really think it's a middleman. It's just like saying with any value-added activity, you bring in raw material, you add value and you sell it.
But it makes it interesting because Russian oil is something that has been a bit of a debate, and there's been Western pressure
in the recent past,
since the war in Ukraine
before that,
started.
Everybody else was not a problem. And even after the war.
But India has been buying more and more Russian oil after the war in Ukraine started.
Because the price of the Russian oil became cheaper.
Yeah.
Yes. So hence it made sense, the economic sense for India to do what was in best of India's national interest.
But some say that India is also very smartly exploiting a temporary loophole in the system.
But like which system? Who defines the which system is India exploiting the loophole?
Mm-hmm.
India has always stated, as our foreign minister, that India is doing what is best for in India's interest. Mm-hmm. An arbitrage opportunity comes. India is able to secure large quantities of Russian oil at a cheap price, both for refining as well as for domestic use. India steps in. India, if India didn't have any refining capacity, India wouldn't have been able to do anything about it. India's, over the years, has the capacity, makes use of the arbitrage, keeps inflation low, buys oil, sells it. Now, this may be, as I said, economically, there is nothing wrong with it, right? It's the right thing to do with any market opportunity. Assume there was no geopolitics about it, the United States would have done this, or Singapore would have done it, right? So to say that India exploited the opportunity is not the right word. India economically used the opportunity.
New Delhi and Moscow, they want the trade deal to hit $100 billion in some years. Is that very ambitious?
No, I don't think so. I think both India and Russia have huge synergies in terms of what they can trade. India is a fast-growing economy. Russia offers a lot of historical manufacturing capabilities as well as natural resources. India has a need for those natural resources, and India could do a lot with the Russian manufacturing. India, on the other hand, offers financial services, large markets, an ability to deploy significant amounts of capital, and now increasing technology that Russia could use.
as Russia turns east, where do you think India stands? Do you see India becoming a core pillar in Russia's eastern strategy, or do you think that India is just one of the many options for Moscow?
I mean, I hope and I presume that India will be one of the core pillars of the Russian east strategy, because India is probably one of the most, is a very dependable and the oldest Russian ally in this part of the world, and has been a very consistent partner with Russia. And even through these crises, has demonstrated to the Russians and the world that India is a dependable and a loyal partner.
If Western sanctions on Russia, they further tighten, what are the second order risks for India, especially in the banking sector, say in the shipping sector, in the energy pricing?
It will disrupt, as it has disrupted our capital flows between Russia and India, the disruption of the banking flows, the SWIFT flows. So I think that will continue until Russia and India establish them of their own domestic platforms for movement of capital. And I think this crisis over the last few years has accelerated that effort. So that's one area where I think there could be disruption. Of course, fuel supplies is another. You know, India is dependent on Russian oil. And if Russian oil gets, there are sanctions, it just increases the cost of dealing with that oil.
What do you think explains India's almost nonchalant attitude towards the unilateral sanctions that the West has imposed on Moscow?
India has been for always advocating the fact that, you know, this war must come to an end, and that, Russian interests must also be protected, while the Western viewpoint is being appreciated in terms of this conflict. So I think India has not taken such a nonchalant attitude towards Russians, to Western sanctions. India's stand has more been that end the war, remove the sanctions, and let the world come back to normalcy as quickly as possible.
I want to talk about the United Nations for a second. Everybody has been talking about how weak it has become, especially during the recent conflicts. Has the UN failed?
I wouldn't say it has failed. It served a purpose, and served the purpose well, since the end of the war, 1945, to now 2026. We have seen probably nearly about 80 years of no big conflict, probably the longest time in human history when no major conflict has broken out. But everything changes with time. And I think the question to ask is that, has the United States lost its utility now? Not as a failure or success, but in the world of tomorrow, will United Nations continue to be as relevant as it has been in the past, or will it have relevance? Data coming out in the last few years is showing that UN is increasingly becoming irrelevant, and that UN must redesign itself, must reimagine itself, or what kind of an organization it will be to maintain, to be future ready. Of course, the world needs an organization like the UN, which has common rules, common protocols that the whole world agrees to maintain global peace. But in its current form, is the UN appropriate and capable? For example, how can there be a UN where have a Security Council with veto power with only 5 countries when a country like India is not part of that? This doesn't make any sense anymore.
India is holding the BRICS presidency this year. There's a lot being talked about how the grouping is so divided and it's almost broken. But do you not think, Shaurya Dhawal, that grown-ups, when I say grown-ups, I mean countries, they can have their own opinions about a particular issue? Why is there this constant need on having a consensus?
I think, well, there are two different questions. But the need to have a consensus, like in any relationship between individuals, within countries, in society, is needed to move forward. If you and I don't have a consensus on having this interview, we can't have this. You won't ask the questions, I won't answer them. But we have to have a consensus to move forward. But we don't need to have the same opinions to have an interview. You may hold your opinion, I may hold my opinion. As long as we agree, have a consensus on how we are going to conduct this interview, we can move forward. I think similar is true with countries. Countries don't need to hold same opinions. Countries can have different of opinions, but countries must have a protocol of how they must exchange those opinions and how they can move forward, even if their opinions, they're not a complete agreement.
So do you think India's BRICS presidency could add value? 100%,
because you see, BRICS presidency represents a global alternate order of important countries, particularly for the global south. So I think the BRICS is a very relevant organization. It's a very future relevant organization. Just like you said, was the UN a past success but a future ready organization? I think BRICS has your future relevance. Now, of course, a lot depends upon how the countries come together, how do they take, tangible measures. But from the track record that they've been doing, look at the BRICS bank that has come up. It's a significant alternative, at least a start, to what was historically the World Bank and the only other mechanism of a multilateral institution.
A lot has been talked about de-dollarization. Has that started already, or is that wishful thinking?
There is a space for an alternative currency. But I think it's a little bit premature to say that the world will move to a de-dollarized environment or a world order for quite soon. Just given the size of the U.S. economy and given the size of the U.S. influence on the global GDP, that, de-dollarization is not going to happen anytime soon. And from the sounds of it, the United States is not going to really allow, after the Second World War, when the dollar replaced the gold standard, to allow this to happen so easily. So people shouldn't get their hopes up. And it looks very sexy to say, now de-dollarization is going to happen and all. But I don't think practically, even as a professional, I can see any currency replace the dollar anytime soon.
The United States under Trump. Sanctions, tariffs, financial pressure. The US is increasingly using economics as a leverage, many say. Do you think that this is leadership, or do you think they're operating on ego?
I think United States has definitely got an agenda, and rightly so. They are doing what is best in their country's interest. And from the sounds of it, they aren't doing too bad. It is making significant investments in AI and technology, which is getting itself future ready. It's data that has come out in the last 2-3 days about consumer confidence, jobs, employment, even GDP growth rate shows that the United States is on a trajectory which is where it wanted to be. And it's increasing the gap between itself and China significantly, which will make it difficult for China to catch up with the United States.
But you tell me, what's going on? Because the India-US trade deal, that also keeps stalling, and it's been stalling for a while now. What is the real issue here? Is it economics or is it trust?
No, I think, United States has a very strong GDP. It is at $32 trillion. It's trying to do a free trade agreement with a $4 trillion GDP. Let's be realistic, right? It's going to take time. United States is 8 times the size of India in terms of economic growth today. So they're going to use all their pressure that they have to try and secure the best deal. India on its hand is going from $4 trillion to $8 trillion, moving faster than the United States, catching up. India is going to resist giving the United States the concessions and access it wants to the Indian markets. And therefore, I think any trade deal on that, even if I take the geopolitics aside, it's just a matter of them coming to a common ground, which is, I think, we're going to take time. It's not going to be that easy.
But Donald Trump's second presidency, do you not think that it's been nightmarish for India? I mean,
it's been nightmarish for the world, not just India. India is not the only country for whom it's been nightmarish. You can see it's been nightmarish for the world. Mr. Trump has decided to take a very aggressive posture on using American hard power in terms of projecting hard power, whether it's from Venezuela to Iran. And then we're only about a year or so more into his presidency. We've still got 3 years left, or 2.5 years left. So I think it's going to be quite a rollercoaster.
But there's going to be midterms, so that might change things.
Well, not to his, but they might change the domestic politics in the United States, and maybe
a weaker Trump.
Weaker Trump may slow him down. But obviously, I think, it's not going to stop him.
And how do you define India's approach to dealing with the Trump? Because India's been very calm, very composed, doesn't react, almost never.
The way you made it sound looks like a very mature reaction, whether it's a country or an individual.
Mm-hmm.
When things are sort of disturbed, the best thing is not to react. India has its long-term interests. India has its long-term view. India must pursue that long-term view. And India must manage the short-term.
There are shifts inside OPEC. Are we entering a more unstable energy order? What does it really mean for India, for Russia and the world?
I think we are entering into a world of definitely more volatile energy world, where there's going to be greater volatility in energy prices. What it means for India and Russia is that it must secure their energy supplies and make them as stable as quickly as possible in the short run, so that they suffer less of this volatility, and don't let powers use oil as a tool of leverage in geopolitics. In the medium to long term, both India and Russia should think about energy sovereignty, how they can ensure that their energy supplies are sovereign of these kind, are sovereign and less subject to these kind of pressures. And I think that's really should be the strategy in this world right now.
Many say that China's prepared for shocks, especially energy. Do you think that India's been too relaxed when it comes to energy security?
No, I don't think so. I think India has also been quite relentless under Mr. Modi to try and ensure energy supply security. This whole emphasis on solar and alternative energy is really driven by that, is to come back to reduce the increase of, you know, ethanol, etc., in oil, to go for driver EV cars, etc., is to really reduce our dependence on energy imports. Now, having said that, it's a humongous task. We started with 75% dependence on energy imports. We don't have oil, we don't have coal. So it's going to take time to do it, and it won't be easy. Because you're a growing economy and energy fuels your economic growth.
India wants to be developed by 2047, the idea of Viksit Bharat under Narendra Modi, India's Prime Minister. Realistic?
Oh, very realistic. Very, very realistic. And it's not only realistic, it's quite achievable. Because you see, what is the definition of Viksit Bharat? Well, I mean, there are many, you know, many India on many social parameters achieves already the definition of a Viksit Bharat. But one big benchmark of that is India's per capita income. Right, which is an indicator of at what per capita income in a country becomes developed as against developing. That number is about $12,000. India is about $3,000 today in terms of its per capita income. India needs to increase its per capita income four times to be able to increase that. India's population is more or less constant, about 1.5 trillion. That's not going to go up. Oh, sorry, 1.5 billion. That's not going to grow up anytime soon. Then all India needs to take its GDP from 4 trillion to four times.
Which is quite a lot.
No, not quite a lot. That's what I said, compounding. That's the power of compounding. You see, I'll give you some statistic to see how power of compounding works. India was 30 billion when the British left us in 1947. India took 50 years to become 300 billion. So in 1997, we are 300 billion. India became a $1 trillion economy in 2007. So from 30 billion to $1 trillion took us from 1947 to 2007, that's 60 years. It took us, India, only from 2007 to 2014. That is 7 years. To what India had achieved in 60 years, India became from 1 trillion to 2 trillion in 2014. So 60 years, 1 trillion. Next 7 years, another trillion. Then it took us from 2014 to 2019 to become 3 trillion. That's only 5 years. If COVID hadn't hit, we would have been 4 trillion much earlier. We are in 75 years, 4 trillion. Now you yourself are saying that in next 10 years, we'll be 8 trillion.
7.3
by 2030 and 20, you know, by let's say 8 by in next 10 years, by 2025, 2035. But if you take that 8, that's 8, and then it becomes 16. So what becomes 4, 8, then 16? That's compounding. So if you do that mathematics, sooner or later, India hits very close to being a developed country by the time 2047 comes, if not already there.
On that note, Shaurya Dhawal, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me over. Bye-bye. Thank you.